This is Liquidity Talks, a live stream and podcast series designed to share the latest trends and updates from the world of treasury, liquidity, and risk. Join us as we power up the liquidity conversation.
Hello and welcome to our latest instalment of Liquidity Talks, live stream and podcast. I'm Neville Roberts, CEO and founder of Planix, the market-leading fintech focused on real-time treasury, liquidity and risk. Now, our topic today is entitled Intraday Liquidity Shaping Financial Stability. Welcome to all our audience today. Good morning, good afternoon and evening, wherever you may be. Anyone in the audience can ask a question whenever they want. If you put it on the comment section you see on the right-hand side of your screen, these will come up and we'll see them. We can ask them as we go, or if we get too many or we get some at the end or after it, we'll make sure we'll answer them and send them after the event. If you do ask a question, if you could please let us know who you are and if you possibly can, your role, so we have some context to the question. Another thing for the audience today is we've had a few audience members in the past ask if they could be part of the podcast. So if you do want to and you'd like to be with in a podcast, if you just email Nick Appleby or Adam Pemberton, their emails will come in the comment section any second and we can make that happen. Now, today I'm joined by someone I've known for a number of years, our guest speaker. It's Barry Lewis from Elixir. So Barry, welcome today. Would you like to introduce yourself? Tell us who you are and what you do.
Yeah. Hi, Neville. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Barry Lewis. I've got a very long history in the city. I started as a messenger in 1970, delivering stock around the city and then making sure that we picked up the checks and then banked them before 3 o'clock. So I've really been focusing on intraday liquidity for about 50 odd years. I've had a long career in operations, initially with some stockbrokers. Then I worked at Credit Suisse First Boston in the early days. Companies like Salomon Brothers. I ran global ops at Barclays, BZW, and then spent quite a lot of time back at Credit Suisse, where I ran various programs, including focusing a lot on liquidity. I retired in 2012. Clearly, haven't done a very good job at retiring. I then joined an Elixir, which was a very small consultancy then. We're like four people. We're now something like 700 people. And I really spend my time when I'm not retired, just helping clients around the world, focus on many initiatives. But my pet subject, my favorite conversation, is always around the importance of liquidity, and particularly intraday liquidity.
Brilliant. I was just thinking then that all those years ago, liquidity was around walking checks around the city. I mean, there's some amazing stories that are probably you can tell, some of which you probably can't tell, but we'll get into that in a minute. Now, as you probably know, Barry, we like to talk football at the start of these sessions, a bit of an icebreaker. And I'm delighted to ask you the question because I know the answer. If we want to talk about football, who is your team and why?
So my team is Liverpool. My wife is from Liverpool. I lived up there when I first got married, which was many, many years ago. My local team, which I probably shouldn't tell you this, is Charlton Athletic, but that's almost the end of the conversation. So we should focus on Liverpool. A great, great success story. Absolutely. Good to see them top of the league at the moment.
Excellent. Leagues. excellent answer, Barry. And if you ask me my local team from the past, it's a team a lot of people have probably never heard of them. It's actually called Marine, which is a little team in Crosby in Liverpool. I actually started supporting them and Liverpool many, many, many moons ago. But great to hear. You're a good man, Barry. So look, straight to the topic today, intraday liquidity shaping financial stability. So look, let's just start with some scenes setting context. Obviously, you've got a very, very rich history. How has liquidity and intraday liquidity management evolved, say, in the last 15, 20 years?
So the reality is, running big operations at Credit Suisse, we were trading 10 million trades a day, massive numbers floating around all the time. No one really spoke about intraday exposure prior to 2008, when Lehman's went under. There was no intraday overdraft charges. There was nothing proactively measured. It was all about what are the balances at the end of the day. We always assumed that our agent banks would look after us and make sure that whatever was necessary, they would make those payments. During the final weeks of Lehman's, when everyone started to realize there was a problem, and in my mind, it was the first serious problem in the 50 years or so I've been working in this industry. The big banks, the clearing banks, did what they're supposed to do, which was they protecting their own shareholders. So they pulled back on credit. They demanded collateral before they would release any payments to make sure that their exposure was minimal. So that really, I think, shocked the world. The UK regulators quickly began to understand the importance of the issue, and they came out with some pretty rudimental requirements to make sure that people measuring their exposure the best you could. And you know, the banks wouldn't tell you what credit line you had in place. There were messages coming through 900, 910s, but it was very difficult to try to monitor those manually to really understand what the situation was. And the capital requirements were calculated by some finance people that weren't close enough to what was actually going on in the operational world to see the cash. So they would often assume that it was just an assumed perfect settlement, and therefore a top-down number was applied. The Treasury ops teams, who did have an idea of the exposure, they didn't have the available technology. I remember, again, at my old shop, we were doing it on spreadsheets the best we could, trying to calculate numbers. But we weren't really aware of the capital issue, and so never the twain should meet. The non-Treasury ops teams, and this was difficult times, they were making sure that every trade was matched, every trade settled on time. They didn't really think about the liquidity requirements and what was actually happening intraday. In addition to that, I guess, in the last 15 to 20 years, as per your question, interest rates since 2008 were pretty minimal for at least a decade, probably a bit more than that. So this was never really seen to be such an important issue because the cost of it was pretty minimal. As a consultant in 2012, you know, I was going around talking to institutions around the world, and they all said, yeah, we understand the issue, but it's not important enough on our radar because of the minimal cost.
Yeah, and look, when I think about a good friend of ours, when he was talking to me about his time at Credit Suisse, and when he was charged with looking at intraday liquidity, took him 3 weeks on a spreadsheet to get a view of just that day. And it's, you know, 3 weeks now is forever. So it just takes a long time, even with Excel. But I guess with interest rates being historically over the last 10 years or so low, it almost masked the problem that was there because money was cheap, right? So it was easy to overfund and kind of who cares. But when interest rates go up, it becomes a real challenge and issue. So I can see why it's important now, of course I can, but you know, why is effective intraday liquidity management, you know, crucial? It's of crucial importance to financial institutions today. Yeah. Why is that?
So roll forward 16 years since Lehman's went under. And the underlying markets are still pretty fragile from a liquidity perspective. We saw what happened with SVB. We saw what happened with Credit Suisse just over about a year ago. The regulators see that. Everyone now talks about liquidity and the importance of liquidity. And the regulators are now coming in and saying, you need to evidence that you're doing things properly. Show us that you're doing it. And if you can't, then they're going to come in with a charge. And capital charges, because of the rise in interest rates, are getting more expensive. I was mentioning previously that I'm currently reading the book about Credit Suisse's demise, meltdown. And that highlighted in this new day and age with social media, how everything is now accentuated. And you can have a rumor starts, you know, on the West Coast, and Asia come in the next morning, they see it happening, people start to pull their money out. And at Credit Suisse, again, according to this book, clients were pulling $10 billion out every single day. And you then get into this death spiral. And so everyone's now aware that things could go wrong quickly, much more expensively. Reputationally, it's a massive challenge. So you have to make sure that you're focusing appropriately on intraday liquidity.
Yeah, and I think, look, we've often talked on this podcast about Northern Rock, right? When Northern Rock happened, it unfolded within weeks, whereas with SVB, Credit Suisse, things happen now with social media in days, if not hours. And as soon as you go over that kind of that hurdle, you're too far gone, and it's just this spiral, isn't it?
Run on a bank used to be a queue of people outside waiting to draw their cash. Now they press a button on their phone, and billions are flowing out. It's a very, very different scenario.
No, I've got it. So look, that's one of the challenges. But you know, what are the other main challenges in managing your intraday liquidity, Barry?
So, at the end of the day, any form of liquidity is a cost to an institution. Those costs will get allocated onto the businesses. So the business leads have to ask the question, you know, what's happening? Why are these charges so high? What do we need to do to bring them down? And therefore, they all know about intraday liquidity. They know about these buffers that everyone's holding. So they need to start from the top of the organization and say, what are we doing about it? Make it a top of the radar agenda point. They need to make sure that they spend the right money, they invest the right money in the technology. As we said at Credit Suisse all those years ago, we managed to work out today's number 3 weeks later. Yeah. 3 weeks, a bank is dead. And so you really now need to say, how do I best manage all this data that's coming in? And data is available. How do I best manage that and then optimize my position? You need to then make sure that you're managing you're learning from that data transparency. And the data transparency is both on the inputs, i.e. what time am I receiving the money, where's it from, etc., and on the outputs. So when should I be sending the money out in order to manage my overall position? And then you need to make sure that you leverage that data to change behavior, not simply say, yeah, I've got this data, and tell the regulator that it's now under control. You now need to evidence that you're doing the right thing. And doing the right thing, in my mind, is looking at how do you improve your settlement netting rates, so you're not moving all the gross cash around. You're making sure you're leveraging clearing houses where appropriate. You're internalizing your intercompany transactions wherever possible. And then you're managing your timing of the payments released. It doesn't mean hold everything back, because you're going to cause blockages, but it means doing it all in a sensible manner.
Got it. And you know, you said this comes from top of the house. We often see this owned in treasury, in operations and risk, and in the customers we have, it varies. It's mainly owned in treasury, but do you think it should be owned higher than that, or it is literally split between those three areas in a bank?
So I think treasury is the right area to own it.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones that proactively go out and source funding, etc. But the treasury charges then go to the businesses. And it's often the businesses that have to make the investments into the processes. If you talk to treasury, they will often say, yeah, we need to change the operational processes, but we don't own the operations. They report into a different group or into a business leader, etc. So you need to influence from where the pain is being felt. And it's often at the equity business or the fixed income business that's feeling this pain. They should therefore be prodding to make sure that this is being looked at properly.
Got it. So look, how have the challenges and drivers influencing the business case? How have they changed over time?
So again, interest rates kick in straight away. There's no doubt about it. But there's a combination of capital charges from the new requirements. The cost of funding, is Treasury adding on a big buffer to account for the fact it has to leave all this extra money there all the time? And what's happening to the rest of the cash? Where's the collateral balances that are being held? So all of this needs to be understood in terms of the charge out that hits the business. So if a big number hits the business, they often say it's just a number, I can't really question it. Well, they have to question it, they have to understand what are the drivers of those charges that are hitting them. It blows my mind, you know, after excuse me, we said this much of this was really come to the fore in 2008, so 16 or so years ago. There's still something like 48% of the global FX business settles on a bilateral basis, on a cash basis, which shows that too many institutions still don't really understand the causes of poor liquidity. And if you can't manage your overall liquidity, you're not going to be able to manage your intraday liquidity at all. So you need to see these things in a continuum to make sure you're optimizing the situation.
Yeah, and look, I'm thinking about data as well here, Barry. There's, you know, data's everywhere, and you know, we realized probably 3 years ago that, you know, we have implied, we've got a lot of control processes, you know, control intraday liquidity, look at stress management, all of the functions you need to. But we realized that the data that comes out of this is just as important, valuable as the processes that are controlled. So we find it very, I mean, banks are amazing, you know, it's amazing what they can do with this now. They apply their analytics, their reporting, AI. So, you know, how can financial institutions use data and analytics to improve IDL?
It's fascinating because every institution we talk to, the first thing we do, we say, right, let's have a look at your data. And most of the time they don't have it. So you then have to pull data out from 900 Swift messages and all this sort of thing, and then try to create a picture. And then you show that to the institution, and they say, oh, no, that can't be true. But it's their data. Yeah. And because they don't look at it in the way that you should do if you're trying to manage this, you're trying to optimize your liquidity, they often look surprised. So leveraging solutions such as yours, where you can actually access and utilize real-time data. And it's really important that you're looking at real-time data, not what happened yesterday, but you're looking at real-time data. And that real-time data is both for value today and subsequent. So you're then building up a picture of what it's going to look like in the coming days. And then you're measuring against actual. And again, institutions say, oh, I can't get the 900 and the 910s, or I can't get real-time data from my banks. Well, there's no reason why you can't.
That's
if they can't do it, then change your bank account.
Yeah, agreed.
But this is nearly 2025. That sort of stuff should be available. But once you've got that and you've got smart data, then you can look at who's paying you late every day. You can begin to manage your true exposure by counterparty. You talk to the credit team and they would just say, yeah, my credit with Deutsche Bank is now finished because today's settlement date. Well, it's not finished if they haven't paid you. And so you need to measure your actual exposure to what's actually happening, not what should happen or what did happen, what's actually happening. And that's the way you can leverage the data. But you need the core, the raw data, to come into some form of solution in order to manage it properly.
No, look, I agree. The start and end of the day can be fine. It's what happens in the middle of the day and how it's profiled out. Also, the forecasting of the rest of the day and the end of the day, that's as critical as well. And, you know, we always talk about everything. You know, everything's moving to real time. You know, social media is making everything with banks real time. Everything's moving that way. So the more accurate you can have your inputs and your insights, the more accurate you'll be when you're estimating these things. So totally agree. So look, let's move on to buffers and reserves.
What's really smart is when you look at intraday liquidity, so you're measuring what's going in and out of your bank account. If you're smart, you can start to do real-time reconciliations. Exactly. The amount of institutions that people talk about liquidity management here, and then they still have a different team, now the next day begin to look at bank reconciliations. It's so inefficient. It's the same data. So working smartly with the same data is what's going to help.
Yeah, and you know, I've always said real-time reconciliation, it's very hard to do, but if you can do it, your best chance to get an accurate forecast throughout the end of the day to the rest of the day.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. Right, we've got a question here. It's from Nick Nichols. Here we go. Do we think the new ECB guidelines on best practices are the start of a sea change in managing intraday liquidity better across the industry. Thanks for that, Nick. Barry, what do you think about that? The new ECB regs that came out, or guidelines, should we say?
I think they're clearly eminently sensible. But they're not the first time someone's put out some sensible guidelines in this, on this subject. And until people are actually measured against them and penalised against them, I'm not sure what difference it's going to make. You and I could have had this conversation 5 years ago. And you've made some great progress with your platform. There's another couple of platforms that are making similar progress. But there's still many, many institutions that are not using any of those platforms, still trying to do it on the back of a fag packet, and don't really measure the output. I think the regulators, and you know, the ECB clearly is a great starting point, have to keep driving that forward and really doing deep dives and say, show me how you're managing this. Yeah. That, and internally, people saying, why am I picking up all these funding costs that are now at 5 or 6% as opposed to the 1% it has been the last 10 years? And I think that's what's going to change.
I totally agree. Look, the guidelines are great. They're sensible. They're not over the top. They're not underplayed. It's the enforcement of them. It's when the regulator turns up to a bank, they've got to say, we said this, this is what you need to do, and we'll measure them against them, and we're going to score you, and you know, this is how you need to improve. But enforce that, because if they don't, it's words, right? But we hope that's going to come, and more need.
My point is that this should be sensible business management. Exactly. It shouldn't be you're doing it just because the regulator tells you to. There's enough horror stories of how banks have got it wrong and just aren't measuring and managing these things properly, that sensible business management will enforce you to do, will encourage you to do this. If I'm, when I was running big chunks of Credit Suisse, the amount of times that we'd be forced to focus on cost cutting, I would much rather focus on cost optimization and get rid of this cost rather than cutting 10 heads somewhere.
No, absolutely. So look, let's move on to buffers, reserves. It's always, you know, talked about, but you know, what's your opinion on how a financial institution balances the need for liquidity versus the cost of holding an excess?
So this is always an interesting subject, and you know, different people, it depends where you are in an institution. My view is that holding a large buffer instead of proactively managing the liquidity requirements is a cop-out. It's simply saying, I can't manage it properly, stick a big buffer in there, and we can carry on. We've got other priorities. With interest rates rising, you know, they're flattening a bit now, but they're going to keep going in one direction, in my opinion. Institutions need to ensure that they're optimizing their cash positions and treating them as a prime asset rather than just a figure on the balance sheet, cash at bank. Now, this is this is what financial institutions are all about, and managing the liquidity. There's nothing more important.
Yeah, we've heard many banks say to us, we've got no problems here because we've got so much liquidity, you wouldn't believe it. We're fine. It's like, there's your opportunity.
I remember, again, I don't want to take up too much time, but we had meetings with the ex-treasurer of Lehman Brothers, and she was showing us some data where in August they had stacks of available liquidity, and middle of September that had been sucked dry by all sorts of things happening, clearing houses demanding extra collateral. They're clearing agents saying you have to pay us before we release anything. You can start with a big number, but very quickly that will go down to a small number that's not big enough to keep you going.
Way too small. Yeah. Okay. So look, how do FIs, how do they integrate IDL with their overall risk management framework? A question we're asked often.
And it's a great question. And the reality is, I don't think it's currently coordinated anywhere near enough. So front to back risk coordination is key. There's too much silo thinking, you know, what's my credit exposure? What's my market exposure? What's my liquidity exposure? And all of those things are pretty much one and the same. at the end of the day. So you need to think about this being a firm-wide challenge and fund it down these multiple different lines of defence. The regulators now see IDL as a key part of the overall risk exposure of a bank. They expect it to be measured and managed just as you measure the other sort of risks. So it needs a lot of education to make sure that people understand how these things fit together. And I think that's probably a Treasury responsibility, but people need to listen and they need to say, well, so me managing my credit exposure in the way I currently do isn't taking the intraday stuff into account. I need to change the thinking. But to do that, you need the data. So if you're only looking at end of day data, then you're always going to struggle.
Yeah, got it. So looking ahead, Barry, what future trends, opportunities do you see in IDL?
The reality is the world's changing quickly. I think as a negative, I think T1 is coming.
Yeah.
It's here in the US. It's coming in the rest of the world. That's going to put even more pressure on processes. And you need to make sure that stuff is right today, as opposed to looking tomorrow and say, I've still got another day to do it. So the issue will get tighter because of T1. Yeah. Against that, you've got AI is coming. AI is going to give you a lot more ability to actually leverage the data to then forecast what's going to happen. DLT / blockchain, now they're clearly great solutions. And once the world begins to leverage those and joins things up properly, I can see that eliminating much of the problems. But in all honesty, for the foreseeable future, you're going to have to continue to have digital and non-digital cash activity taking place. So you can't simply sit there and say, it's all going to be solved soon. I don't need to worry too much about it.
And do you see T1 coming to the rest of the world in the short term? And any views on T0?
I see T1 coming.
Yeah.
When I first started in UK market, it used to settle every 2 weeks. And so it's absolutely coming down. But the reality is, while you've still got your currency value dates happening at a different time to your security value dates, now there's an awful lot of coordination. So I don't think we get T0 real time yet until you get to DLT and blockchain. Everything is on the single ledger, it's all instantaneous. I absolutely see that happening. But in the non-digital world, I don't think we'll be getting there in my lifetime, which is probably not that long, really.
Oh, I'm sure there's a few years left there, Barry. Don't you worry. Look, finally, because we're running out of time, it's been a really quick half an hour, but what are your key takeaways for the viewers today? And if there's one piece of advice out of that you'd like them to go away with and leave them with, what would that be?
So I guess from a year to date, I think it's fantastic that there is now more focus on this subject. Partly driven by interest rates, partly driven by regulators stepping back and looking back last 2023 and realizing big banks can still go under with poor liquidity driven by this new world of social messaging, etc. But I think the key message for me is IDL is not rocket science. It's basically appreciating that for every single transaction, for every single exposure, there's a cash flow. And you need to understand that cash flow. You need to measure it. You need to monitor it, just as I think you would generally with your own money. Just thinking my clearing agent network is going to always protect me, your strategy is based on trust. Yeah. And when things start to go wrong, trust will very, very quickly liquidate. And so you need to make sure that you're managing yourself. And you're doing this properly, using the right tools. Don't just wait for the regulator to tell you it's wrong. Just make it happen.
Perfect. Well, Barry, look, thanks very much for that. We indeed have run out of time. So thanks very much, Barry, for joining us today and sharing your views. If anyone asks any questions after the event, no problem. We will answer them and get back to you later. That concludes our latest Liquidity Talks live stream and podcast. We'll be putting the podcast on LinkedIn, Spotify, Apple Music, and other media outlets and streaming services very soon. Thank you very much for tuning in today. Look out for our next podcast coming next month. My name is Neville Roberts. Thank you for tuning in and goodbye.
You've been listening to Liquidity Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on the latest developments and industry opinion from the world of treasury, liquidity, and risk.